Hello, listeners, and thank you for tuning in to the Batuta Advocate radio show or podcast if you're listening from outside our humble inland town. My name is Errol Parker, and this show is coming out of the capital of the Sunshine State.
Yes, my name is Clancy Overall as well. Thank you for listening. Yep, down in Brisbane right now. So if you're listening back home in Batuta on Desert Rock FM, we're glad the audio has made it back to Diamantina Shire.
We are down here, of course, because of the Batuta Advocate Roadshow is in full swing. We've thoroughly enjoyed meeting the good people who've come out to see us across the northern cities, and now we're heading down south.
Yes, it's been great so far, and if you're listening to our show from down south, make sure to come and grab some tickets to see us when we come to your town for the Batuta Advocate Roadshow.
Now, this week on the show, we are talking to cricketing royalty, a man who has seen the highest highs of our national team and has since become an institution in the coverage of the game.
His name is Ian Healy, and he has done it all. One of our greatest ever players, and today he's going to offer up some insight into what's currently going on in the game.
That, and we're about to have a chat with Ian in his office, which is above one of his many car washes. So there's a bit of background noise and a few toots here and there.
Yes, on top of Hoppy's car wash down in Norman Park. He's got them all over town if you live in Brisbane. And yeah, he's got a lot going on. Let's have a chat about it all.
Yeah, let's get into it.
Well, here we are in Brisbane City as the Batuta Advocate Roadshow continues around the country. All 13 dates currently in Brisbane now in the breathtaking Griffith Electorate, sitting here with an icon of Australian cricket and Brisbane in itself, Ian Healy. How are you, mate?
Very well. Nice to have you, fellas.
Thanks for having us over here.
I only found out yesterday that it was the Griffith Electorate, actually.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've had Kevin Rudd's head blasted everywhere around here, I guess.
So we're up here on the top floor of your car wash. There's been a few developments down there in the Big Smoke down there in Sydney, at Cricket Australia. Mm. Is there any way they could kind of lure you out of the car wash game and and down onto the board, you know, to right the ship?
Well, no, I'm not right in the mood for punishment just yet. I'll stay with the car wash. No, we've got this car wash group which occupies our time and my time outside of commentary, which is great, and also the Greek Chapel Cricket Centre,
yep.
Where we've got eight or nine stores around the country now. So I've got plenty on my plate. The broadcasting double up started to become an issue for Mark Taylor, you know, even though he'd been there 13 years and he wasn't involved in the broadcasting rights deal. But all of a sudden that became a conflict of interest. So I'd have the same conflict, I'd imagine. So getting into that board mightn't be possible.
Fox is now the new kids on the block.
Yeah.
How's that all looking?
Yeah, well, it looks fantastic. The energy level and the intensity and excitement around the Fox offices is something to experience. You know, we've been down there a fair bit doing promos and wardrobe and photographs and those sorts of things. And, gee, it's a busy, hectic place, which is great. You know, my history and knowledge is only Channel 9, which are separated a lot in cottages, you know, each of the departments. So when you put it all in one building, wow, there's plenty happening. So it was great. They're certainly making a huge effort. They're throwing a lot of people at it, which means a lot of money. And let's see what they produce.
Yeah, right. I suppose the culture there would be a bit different to the early days of Channel 9, where you had a big overlord of Kerry Packer there, you know. Breathing down your neck.
Well, I think it might be quite similar.
Yeah.
You know, Patrick Delaney, the head of Fox, has certainly got his fingerprints into it, and I know even Lachlan Murdoch has asked a few questions, and then the head of sports, Steve Crawley, has come out of a lot of networks that have started things up.
Yep.
So I think that has everyone on tenterhooks, and they're really, really desperate for it to work, and so. What will make it work is Australia playing good cricket and being something we really want to watch, and they've got to make those steps on the field at the moment. But I think, the unknown and the expense that they're going through at the moment probably rivals, you know, the early 80s when the Packer era began.
The revolutionary kind of era of World Series and that kind of stuff. You think that you can see some parallels happening now there, down there in Fox?
Yeah, I reckon. And I'm not, and I can't. You can't really say much. They don't. Yeah. I'm lucky to be there because they don't want to do things differently and claim that they're doing things differently to the way Channel 9 have done it for 40 years and have Channel 9 people all over it. So I've just shut up and let it ride. You know, they're probably doing things. You know, no holds barred, which Channel 9 would have started doing, then they would have found the shortcuts and the corners to cut and expenses to save. So it's really, really interesting and great that they've looked after me.
Now, did you ever think as a young man playing cricket for Australia that you'd end up having to hang out with these blokes for the rest of your life? Because, you know, there's a lot of crossover between the teams you've played in and the commentary teams you now sit with.
Yeah, and I guess that'll happen if you ever have success. Mm-hmm. So we're into the sort of second generation of success now, if you like. You know, Ponting, Gilly and those types of blokes coming through the commentary now. McGrath snuck himself in there and I think Gillespie's going to do a bit. You probably don't think of that you're going to hang out and work together, but it doesn't surprise me that it happens, and it's good fun. You know, cricket's always had the no dickhead rule, and good teams will weed them out. And there's very few, there's none in my time of playing that you know, you wouldn't want to hang out with, and that's probably no coincidence. We were pretty successful
when you guys are really hitting your straps. You know, Warnie, McGrath, kind of. What happens when there's that much talent and that much success? Do you feel like you're kind of not even touching the ground at times, or?
Yeah, it's a good description, actually. It is. You float around the world having fun, and yet you're doing something significant for your country, and you don't understand how much esteem we all get as a country out of a great sporting performance. But you only have to look at India to know the esteem a country can achieve. So, and our Olympic performers, all that sort of stuff, we just love it. But you don't realise that when you're playing. You've just got a singular focus, and that's a pretty simple plan which enables you to cope with pressure and get the job done. Our golden years in my time was 93 to 97, I reckon. From 88 to 93, we sort of built up our confidence. I think they picked character, and I liken it to what they're doing right now. So they picked blokes with temperament that and a sense of humour that even though the early years mightn't be that great, they won't lose confidence. And I would have been one of those selections. Didn't know it. I just was a surprise selection. And then when that temperament becomes comfortable, your talent comes out. Of course, you've got to be talented and have the right skills to emerge and be worthy of playing for Australia. So our skills came out sort of early 90s. We surprisingly won the 89 Ashes. Then in the early 90s, we started to get really comfortable, and Border became a great captain. And then we got a young McGrath and a young Warne, that helps, coming into the fray. And by about 93, Warne was hitting his straps. You know, the two war boys, Taylor and Slater at the top, I was going well. Our bowlers, whether it be Merv Hughes or Bruce Reid early in those years, were going great, McDermott. So we had everything, you know. And didn't worry about any conditions, didn't worry about anything other than simply getting it done on any given day and having fun. You've got to have that a really bright passion for what you're doing too, and that should be obvious. And I look back on some photographs only recently, actually, on our team shots, our dressing room shots and on the field shots, and it's just full of obvious passion that we love being there. So the talent came through. I reckon between the years 93 to 97, Warnie wouldn't have bowled 50 bad balls a year.
Yeah.
It was just, we were just so hard to get on top of.
Yeah.
It was really a good time for cricket in Australia. We all remember it.
Speaking of Alan Border, though, he's been out on the road for Fox for a long, long, long time. Him and BJ been out sort of doing the hard yards, and now their channel's grown into some sort of huge, huge cricket conglomerate now, I suppose it's kind of got a little bit of parallels with how they kind of rebuilt the cricket team themselves, I guess.
Yeah, no,
like
not
out
bad.
Of the dark ages of just getting flogged all through the early 80s up to being the world champions for 20 years.
So what you're saying is Border is just a whipping boy.
He is. He is a slave driver.
I was really pleased for them that Fox were able to get into cricket full time.
Yeah.
Because they have done a great job. On my last tour, the late 90s, Foxtel were on our shirts. Foxtel were our sponsors. And so they've been involved in cricket over 20 years. And now they've got the lot. And it's great that BJ and AB can be a big part of that. Imagine if they didn't bring him on.
Yeah,
Or AB and B, you're finished.
Yeah, thank you for your service, gentlemen. I'm sure we'll hear about it. You'd hear about it at a few corporate lunches, I reckon, anyway.
They'd be speaking at most of them.
Now, you came out of Brisbane State High. Wally Lewis, same kind of alumni coming out of there. Matt Tamua. Was there ever a point in your life where you were a bit like a Jason Little? Or was it always going to be cricket?
It was always going to be cricket, I reckon. Yeah. Before I went to State High, and he went to State High for 1 year. Right. Year 12, I was in the country.
Yeah.
So as
Illawarra.
A country kid, the cricket system allowed me to compare myself as a cricketer to the state kids all around city and country every year. So I knew I was a really good cricketer compared to everyone else, or top rung type stuff. But football wasn't the case. There wasn't a state carnival every year, or that I knew about, or my town was exposed to. I'm not sure, but State High did make me play footy in year 12. So I played. I'd given up league at 16, really. In the country, but came to Brisbane State High, and of course they're in the GPS competition, and I played 1 year of rugby. I was a halfback in league.
Right.
They moved me to 5'8" because I could set up some play. It would not just be a passer, and I was a kicker. And after one game against Auckland Grammar, my first game in rugby was against Auckland Grammar, a powerhouse school in New Zealand, got smashed. And they worked out I was too slow for 5'8", so I had to go inside centre, which is fine. You do 3 tackles a match and you get player of the season.
Yeah.
But it was great. It was a great experience to be able to play that GPS year, and we did pretty well.
Could you see any noticeable differences coming from, up north, Billawheeler way, in the way they play cricket in the bush compared to when you came down to the city?
Not really. No, I didn't notice it because I didn't play junior cricket down here. A high level of my cricket, a high amount of my cricket from 14 years of age upwards was senior cricket in the country and senior representative cricket. So I got well looked after out there. They saw some potential. They knew I was representing well outside my town. And so the men looked after me too.
Yeah.
They got me into rep teams early and didn't do a whole lot. But and then when I came down to Brisbane, I was straight into third grade in club cricket in Brisbane, so I'm not sure how the junior cricket differed. The third grade and club cricket was right on. It was hard, and you had to be sharp each day if you wanted to progress.
So how many games of club did it take you to get up to your state? Because you were only in the state team for about half a season, weren't you? And then
The first question, how many? Well, my career stats are 119 tests, I think 41 Shield games, and about 60 club games. So, and I reckon I'd played 50 of those club games before I'd played for Australia.
Yeah.
So I would have played a club that as soon as I got down to Brisbane, then I went to year 12, played school cricket. And then the next year I played second grade for Norths in Brisbane. Then the following year probably went into first grade. By then I was sort of 20. Then I went... No, I'd had a season in another club actually, because I was in second grade at Norths.
Yep.
Our first grade wicketkeeper organised me to go to Easts, which is here around this area where we are in the electorate of Griffith. And I played a season or two for Easts so that I could be playing first grade when Australian under-19 selection came about.
Right.
They liked to pick blokes who were at least playing first grade, you know. So I did that and then went back to North. So, and then in the state squad, a year after that, I would have got into the state squad. And then eventually, the next year after that, the state keeper, Peter Anderson, number one wicketkeeper, got injured. And I played two Shield games. Then the following year, 1987 or something, he got injured again and gave me four games for Queensland. And then they picked me for Australia. I leapfrogged him as well as everyone else in the country to play for Australia. So my son's now a wicketkeeper, and I say to him, it's easy. It's all you got to do. He might not be having the luck I had.
No.
A lot of the games you've played on paper, were like majority were for Australia?
Yeah, I reckon. Then I played 171 days and a lot of tour matches and first-class games for Australia. Big time. So my dream when I was playing for Queensland, I was the second wicketkeeper for Queensland.
Yep.
I thought the first wicketkeeper, Peter Anderson, would play for Australia. Then they had to get upset with Greg Dyer, the Australian keeper, otherwise none of us were going to get a game, you know. So I thought Ando might play for Australia and that would give me five games for Queensland every year. And I was happy with that. And so I think because I had that that dream, when I was catapulted in, I was half a chance, you know. I sort of had my head into taking a step up. I might as well do this step.
Yeah.
Now, Heels, we're just talking about how you were lucky enough, off the back of Border doing the hard yards, I guess you could say, to be in one of those teams where there's momentum and then there's just everything's working. It's like every match was like a perfect swing at golf most of the time. What do you think should be the immediate plan for the current Australian cricket side? I mean, it's probably hard to give an answer, but do you see things that they could help?
It's quite easy because I reckon they're right where we were in the mid to late 80s. I only came in 1988 and they'd already won the One Day World Cup, so we're starting to move. But, you know, we walked into bars or restaurants and no one spoke to us. Like, no one came out and said, oh, great to have you fellas. I'll buy you a round of drinks or anything like that. Nothing. So you know, and we didn't care. We knew we had work to do. So you've got to get together. You've got to love being there. And you've got to do the hard yards. You've got to train hard. Bobby Simpson just nailed us for hours in every facet of play. Our net sessions, he was one coach that could spot a problem that might emerge. You know, if you're doing this, just made us aware of something you were doing with the bat, and just made you aware of it, because in 3 weeks' time, that could become a problem for you. And then in fielding, short catching, long catching, ground fielding, we're ahead of the world. So they've just got to love all that. They've got to love all that. I reckon their talent will come out when they're comfortable and they're able to relax and concentrate.
I suppose, though, it would be a little bit harder than in the early 90s if just overnight you lost AB and Booney and Craig McDermott, like for a whole year, you know, that'd be a bit hard on you.
It would be extremely hard, you know, especially in a successful year. You know, if you're on the build, you might just keep building for another year. But if you're in a successful year, part of it, and three of your legends go, or you know, you might hit a full stop. That's really difficult. But again, step up. Step up, everyone. Make sure you do your job. I thought, you know, when Cummins and Stark and Hazelwood are in this bowling attack, everyone thinks we're going to win.
Yeah.
They forget to step up. Everyone else has got to do their job. The spinners have got to be perfect. We've got to hold catches. We've got to bat and bat long periods. If plenty's happening with the ball, we've got to do some hard yards with the bat, you know. So, you know, don't just rely on them. And I think good teams, at times when we lost, it was because we thought, we relied on each other. We'll be right. We've still got Warnie, and we'll be right. Yeah. And Tugger will get the runs. So, and before you know it, on a bad day, bang, you're gone. So don't rely on anyone. Get your job done yourself.
Yeah. And even when you didn't have the best spin bowler in the world in your team, you had the second best in
McGillar.
McGillar. Yes. You know, so it was a bit of a golden era, wasn't it?
It was a real golden era. And then you can't forget. In the late 80s, there was plenty of times when we just had normal mortal spinners, Peter Taylor, Peter Sleep. We didn't get an opposition out on the last day. You got to remember that.
True, yeah.
And that's what this team have to go through all the time, every test match.
Yeah.
And so I've got to remember all that. One, I was lucky to be in there. Yes, I might have had the right attitude and we did some good work in there, but I was lucky. You can't have everyone so rookie-ish.
Yeah.
But if you are, you got to remember how bad you were when we were struggling, you know. You've
got to remember that you guys came back from something. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. We started things. They've got a chance to do it right now and get it going and be really successful. I don't like the fact that our bowlers get rested, get rotated at a time where they get paid to be out anyway. Like, burn them, chew them up, and see if they want to stay.
Yeah.
Injuries seem to be high on the communication list at the moment. They should be the things that are hidden.
Yeah.
And players that play with durability are the ones that become legends.
Yeah.
Our fast bowlers these days, if they're to play 100 tests, it's going to take them 25 years.
Yeah.
So we've got to drive some durability into everyone.
Do your fingers ache in the winter?
No, but I'm half a chance. I think they might if I lived in conditions like that would warrant that, in Melbourne or England. Tassie. Every now and then I get a few hot spots, but I'm half a chance up here, I reckon, in Queensland.
Always come inside cleaning those cars downstairs.
That's right. No, my car cleaning career is finished. I did 4 hours once. and I prayed there wasn't another car turning up. I'm the owner.
Just on that, how they've been resting players and everything, did you ever play with a broken hand or a finger or something, you know, just because you had a young fella who was up behind you going nip, 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 nip?
Yeah, it didn't even bother me whether there's a young player or not. I just wanted to rack up games and wanted to keep playing. So if I could play, I would play.
Yeah.
And in that decision to play, you can't let your team down.
Yep.
And you're not spotted on the bench or in the physio room all match. You know, you've just got to deal with your own stuff and get the job done. Merv Hughes was a classic. He was the best we had at playing hurt, playing with pain, and getting the job done.
Yeah.
He didn't let anyone down. But, yeah, broken fingers as a keeper, sure. I'd certainly investigate the ones that could get worse.
Yeah.
But most likely I didn't x-ray my fingers so that I didn't know what I had. And you just treat it like a bruised finger then. It's ice and it's strapping and good treatment, but get out and play. You might not be allowed to do that now.
No.
So we didn't have a doctor.
Yeah.
We had a physio who knew you very well and knew your pain thresholds and knew your ability to do the job with this particular injury. Now a doctor would have to probably rule you out, and they do. They rule you out. So I'm pretty sure our cricketers are putting a few things under the mat themselves these days and not sort of coming totally clean on things like broken fingers.
Yeah.
Now, we interviewed Matt Rogers the other day, and he was talking about, you know, very colourful career for the man between both rugby league and rugby union, and he was saying about the modern footballer in both codes, it's a different beast. And he was saying, I mean, there's positives and there's negatives. He was saying, he's obviously saying with the Wallabies, there's a bit of a brat culture, and there's a lot of, you know, social media has changed these guys as well as their kind of, you know, the way they can supplement their incomes, you know, through social media and that kind of stuff. Have you seen that with the modern cricketer? I mean, they are all very Women's Day friendly nowadays as well. In your era, you weren't getting paid $100,000 for showing people photos of your kids. So have you seen that affect the culture of the game?
Oh, not really, because I just still stay out of it.
Yeah.
I don't. Are they getting that sort of money?
Yeah.
So
Leighton and Beck money.
Yeah. Right. So that would change the culture. I think what has changed our cricketing culture, first of all, our cricketing techniques, is the three forms of the game.
Mm.
Where young players come in, they aspire. The most money's in the T20 side of the game. So they've got to demonstrate to everyone that they can slog. Mm-hmm. They can hit big shots and hit sixes. So our young blokes are coming into dressing rooms thinking, right, I've got to show them that, and then I'll show them my technique later.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's confusing a lot of players and coaches. Yeah. You know, what do you coach your 12-year-old kid nowadays?
Explosive.
You know? Yeah, that's right. Or the scoops over your head, or the reverse sweeps, or do we get balance going? We get them balanced so that they can then branch into those shots. That's a confusing issue. As far as culturally concerned, I think players these days don't, they haven't relied on, might be just an Australian thing, I'm not sure, that they don't rely on camaraderie in the team. Mm-hmm. Like we did. We had to be together. We'd be down in the bar having a little pre-dinner drink and then off to dinner, a lot together, or two big groups going two different spots. They don't do that anymore. I think it's probably because they're playing for so many franchises around the world. They don't have to have that camaraderie. They just go in, get a job done or not, and move on. So an Australian cricketer, you know, will be playing now against South Africa. He might then not be in the T20 side after being the one dayers. Then he comes into the test side. And if he doesn't make the test side, you go to your Big Bash franchise, which... Yeah. It might not be in your state. You might be a New South Wales player, but you're playing for the Adelaide Strikers.
Yeah.
Then they come back, play for their states again. Then they go to the Caribbean Premier League, then the IPL, and they're just playing a lot of teams where you haven't got much time to develop that camaraderie anyway.
And you've got a lot of different mates.
Yeah. I think our state and our national teams haven't noticed that and haven't engendered it back into those teams when they need to.
Yeah.
Because there's no really sort of long tours anymore, are there? Like, you don't really go to the Caribbean for 100 days or...
What's 100 days? Three months. Yeah, it was always 13 weeks, our tour. I'd love to go to the Caribbean for 13 weeks now when the fast bowlers aren't any good. It was a really stressful 13 weeks over there where practice facilities weren't great. They're probably improved now. They've had a World Cup and a bit more investment over there. Practice facility's not great, so if you get behind Kirtley and Courtney, or you know they get on top of you, it's hard to get your confidence back. And then our England tour was 4.5 months.
Yeah,
we wanted six.
That's a long time.
That was a great time, you know. And we just you come from where you've come from.
Yeah,
you know that it was 33 matches in the 1948 tour. In England, and so they've gradually got it down a little bit, and now the players are right behind a 2 month tour rather than having it 4 months, you know. So I think we could spend some more time expanding some tours for the good of cricket.
Two-part question: who is the best bowler you ever kept, and who is the scariest?
Right, Warney is the best bowler I've ever kept too. I think possibly the best bowler in the game that there's ever been. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't deceptive. He couldn't deceive you. Everyone knew what was coming.
Yeah.
So he was easy to read, but it was his accuracy and his relentless passion to be on top of you that's perfect, you know. And he could just put the ball where each and every batsman didn't want it. He was the best. The scariest, you mean to keep to. The fastest spell I ever kept to was Jason Gillespie at Headingley. He had a little breeze behind him, and Headingley is downhill.
Yeah.
And we're down off the square as well at the other end. So the balls were really flying, and some of the English batsmen didn't like it. He got 7 for 43 or 7 for 47, I think, that day. So that's the fastest. But traditionally, Merv was our fastest and scariest bowler. Yep. And you'd hate it when he'd get a wicket because he'd come and slobber all over you. And you just hope the catch goes wide and slips, not to you. You hope someone gets a catch. But if it cannot be me, that would be good because, he's all over you.
So back to Warney, as you said just before, probably one of the best bowlers in human history.
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
What
like?
Other history is he?
Human
animal history.
Well, in modern history that we can document. What was it like watching that happen? Because he was a bit younger than you.
Yeah.
So did you see? Was there people there managing this young kid who had it? Like, did you know?
Sort of. Yeah. I reckon there was, but it was very subtle. It was Bobby Simpson, the coach, who'd heard about him. I got dragged into a Queensland cricket coaching office in the early 90s. Our coaching director here at Queensland, Toot Byron, said, come and have a look at this kid. And it was a West Indies under-19 tour or academy tour or something. And he looked terrible to me. Like, he looked round arm and, like, it's pudgy. But the vision was quite a fair way away. Couldn't really see it. But they said straight away, this fella's real good. So, okay. And then when that started to get out and he started to play, Victoria weren't picking him that much because they had Peter McIntyre, Paul Jackson, a few spinners in front of him. So he was struggling to force his way in there. So they picked him in Australian 11 to go and play the touring team in Hobart a couple of years in a row. And Bobby Simpson was looking at it. And I was the captain of those teams. And Simo really tested him out in the field. He found out that he wasn't a great fielder, but certainly started that. And he had a real maturity about him, like he was 20 or 21 probably. And he reminded me of an old-fashioned country club cricketer that would put his log cabin can of tobacco down as his bowling mark and start from there, you know. And so to me, he just felt really old for how young he was. So I think Simo was really monitoring him. Then would have been putting some pressure on Victoria to get him in so that you could pick him for Australia.
Yeah, well, I did go back the other day and have a look at the highlights from his first game in the baggy green against India at the SCG, and he had a pretty bad day. He was none for 140-odd, I think, in his first innings.
Was it? That was the end of his first innings.
Yeah, right. Like that.
And then Ravi Shastri took him for 200 in the second.
Yeah,
he dropped him, didn't he? He dropped a catch.
Yeah.
So AB said, you keep bowling. You dropped him, you keep bowling. And he's going, oh, no, do I have to? But again, you'll see his willingness to keep going.
Yeah.
We then went to Sri Lanka soon after that, and he was chirping in the dressing room, like encouraging everyone, and he was getting slogged on the field. You know, Kalu with Arana and Arjuna Ranatunga just took to him in the first innings in Colombo, and he was still encouraging everyone in the dressing room, come on, batsman, good luck out there, you know. Yeah. I was starting to think, mate, you better get your own game going, all right, you know. But I sort of let him go, and then that second innings of that test, he got 3 for 11 when Border threw in the ball at the end of a tight finish, you know.
Yeah.
But that's what he was like. He didn't shirk it. He kept bowling, and even if it's none for 140, and he was always there for others, very generous in his enthusiasm for others and the team, you know. So, you know, that's why he's a legend he is.
What do you think he would have done if he didn't play cricket?
Well, he was a salesman for 40 winks, he reckons. He had a blue singlet, you know, like a worker's singlet, drill pants, and, you know, sometimes have jam from his jam donut on his singlet. He reckons this is why he was so impressed with his part-time job. There's a technique where you can get a mattress, a double mattress or even bigger, onto one hand, spin it up and put it on your shoulder and press the button. You know, press the button and then you're standing there with this bed on your shoulder. Say, I'm here to deliver your bed. You can imagine it, couldn't you?
Yeah.
You'd have the big ginger mullet, the jam spill on the blue singlet and the bed on the shoulder. I don't know what he'd do, but I reckon he... So that means he didn't probably play state cricket, you know. If he didn't make it in cricket, oh, who knows what he would do?
Poker.
I haven't even thought of it, but he wouldn't have had money.
No.
So I think at 40 winks might have got him.
He might have found it though. You never know.
And
Fern Tree Valley.
Yeah. And just lastly, what do you think you would have done?
Well, I'd done a couple of things already, and I was a school teacher.
Yeah, right.
And so I'd been through Teachers College and taught for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then I'd left school, left teaching, to go and work with my father-in-law-to-be. And I'd just started 2 weeks before this call came to the office that I was in the Australian team. So I was only just sort of starting selling ladies' fashion fashion agency at South Brisbane,
right
near Brisbane State High. And we didn't really believe that. My dad had to ring ABC Radio and sort of find out if it was real. Because I said to him, mate, I've just been told I'm in the Australian cricket team. He said, bullshit. So he'd rung ABC to check it all out. The next day there, it was Good Friday. And they didn't need media until that day.
Yeah, right.
So Yeah, it was very interesting. I'd have to sort of unfold that, why even the radio stations hadn't rung me or anything days, you know. It was just Queensland Cricket rang me to tell me, well, to congratulate me.
Could have been anyone.
And then they said, well, have you heard the good news? No.
Yeah.
And, so they had to be careful, you know. But they waited till the embargo and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, right.
So I then, our lives changed. I was getting married in 2 weeks' time, and I was in this fashion business. I stayed in it for 2 more years after that, and finally plucked up the courage to tell my father-in-law, oh, look, I've got to go. Yeah. I'd knocked back a sailing trip at Hamilton Island Race Week, you know, with Forex, who are our major sponsor, and I got off the phone, that's it, I'm going in, I'm going in. And I went in to see my father-in-law, and he said, oh, God, I thought you would have gone months ago. Oh, Jesus, no. So I left fashion, but I reckon I would have dabbled around the business world, I reckon.
Well, Heels, thanks for talking to us today. All the best with this year.
And the summer coming up. It'll be a big one.
4K.
Yeah.
4K, Fox.
4K. I live in an apartment now. My building doesn't take IQ, whatever you need to support 4K. We'll get by. It's a high-profile summer.
Yeah.
Great opportunity for the blokes to bounce back. They can produce a team that can win the World Cup at the end of this summer and then go to the Ashes and try to win for the first time in 5 Ashes series. Yeah. That's unacceptable. So I'm looking forward to seeing what Langer does differently and that team plays better in England for once.
Yeah. Yep. Beauty. And Hoppy's Car Wash, for anyone in Brisbane, they've got a range of outlets around the place.
Yeah.
How many you got?
We got a few. We got 11, a couple down the Gold Coast and mainly around Brisbane and southeast Queensland. So thanks for that.
All good.
No worries.
Thanks for having us, mate.
Okay, boys.
And that was Ian Healy. Very insightful interview and one that should be getting you excited for a big summer of cricket coming ahead.
Yes, hopefully you are one of the 1,221 people that can have Fox Cricket broadcast into their home in 4K. Otherwise, you'll have to stick to being an HD piece of shit like we are out in the middle of the Simpson Desert. And until next week, my name is Errol Parker, and never talk to the police without legal counsel present. They are not your friends. They're out to fuck you.
Yes, yes, they are dogs, all of them. And my name's Clancy Overall. You be kind to each other.